Okay. Most of your exposure to weapons of mass destruction, if you haven't been attacked by them, is likely to be from popular culture. Now, that could be the bioweapons that you've seen in the Resident Evil series that attack the famous heroine there. It could be chemical weapons used in the Clone Wars, Star Wars cartoons. Or it could be the nuclear apocalypse scenario that forms the backdrop for the Terminator movie series and the Governator there in the picture. So, weapons of mass destruction are somewhat ubiquitous in our popular culture. And I think it's because of that, you know, everyone likes the apocalypse. It's a real meme that underpins a lot of popular culture today. But we're going to look at it in much more detail. So this is how I'm going to structure today's lecture. So I'm going to look at what are weapons of mass destruction. We'll come up with a definition. We'll look at what they actually do. We'll explore what their purpose is. We'll look at how they've been used in the past, and we'll look at how their use is now governed. And in each of the three case studies I'm looking at, there's international conventions in place to try and restrict the use of these weapons because of their destructive capacity. So here we have the American legal definition of WMDs. And the term weapons of mass destruction means any weapon or device that is intended or has the capability to cause death or serious bodily injury to a significant number of people through the release, dissemination, or impact of A, toxic or poisonous chemicals, B, a disease or organism, or C, radiation or radioactivity. So there you have it, the three categories of WMD that I'm going to look at today: nuclear weapons, chemical weapons, and biological weapons. Now, this definition comes from the US Legal Code, and there's a link in there, so if you want to download the lecture slides later on, there are links in here to the relevant legal texts that you can look at. So, nuclear weapons, what are they? Can anyone fire me a quick definition? What do you think they are? Now, I've been told that this class is heavily engaged in the subject material and I'd like to have a go, so. Sorry? Uncontrolled fission reaction. And you can see from the picture there, that's a pretty uncontrolled explosion, and that's the point. Massive destruction with minimal effort. So the definition I've got here is an explosive device deriving its power from a nuclear fission reaction, which means the splitting of an atom, or a fusion reaction, which means a collision of atoms to fuse into something larger, which is even more powerful. And both of these types of reaction release vast quantities of energy, far more than you would see in an ordinary explosive device. Now, the Federation of American Scientists estimates that there are more than 17,000 nuclear warheads in the world as of last year. Now, that's just a ridiculous number of weapons that could destroy the world many times over. However, only about just over 4,000 of these weapons are actually operational, which means that they could be deployed and targeted if there was a nuclear war right now. The rest are in storage. This is a picture from where? A very famous picture. Yeah, that's right. This is Hiroshima, 1945. It was the first target of a nuclear weapon in recorded history. And this is a really great visual representation of the type of destruction that a nuclear weapon can carry out. So let's explore what the effects of a nuclear explosion are. So first of all, if we consider a 10-megaton bomb, now a 10-megaton bomb is the most powerful that the US deploys in its nuclear arsenal. If we compare with this bomb, this was 0.002 megatons. So picture the destruction there, and then times that by several orders of magnitude when you consider what I'm about to say. So first we have the blast effect of a nuclear explosion. So you have a shock wave, which is a solid wall of air pressure. So that will collapse all brick buildings within 15 kilometres. So if there was a bomb dropped in the Melbourne CBD, every building between there and here would be completely flattened. So that gives you an idea of the size of the blast effect. There's the thermal effect. So that's a heat effect. So you get second-degree skin burns to people within 77 kilometres of ground zero. So that's everyone from here to basically Geelong would receive second-degree burns if a bomb was dropped in the city. And then you get the radiation effect, which is a 10-kilometre-wide fireball. So that, which scoops up debris and converts it into radioactive material. So that would effectively irradiate everything from the city out to Ivanhoe. So one bomb, that's destroying a whole city pretty much. That's a very significant event. Long-term effects from nuclear weapons. Cancer, so you get chromosomal abnormalities caused by the remnant radiation from these bombs that last decades, and we still see that in Japan today. You get immunological disorders. Socially, you have children that become orphans because of just the number of people that get killed in a blast like this. And you get lasting psychological trauma. So again, you can see from these effects why nuclear weapons hold such psychological power as well as destructive power because of these effects, why they're such an effective weapon. Now, the most powerful bomb that was ever tested was the Tsar Bomber, which was a Soviet bomb, which was at 50 megatons. So that's five times more powerful than the most powerful US nuke that they've deployed at the moment. Now, of course, we have seen other cities look like this that have been destroyed by conventional weapons. But to do this with conventional weapons takes more time, takes lots and lots of firepower, lots and lots of air sorties, if you like. One nuclear weapon can do all this in an instant. So, the next question is, how have nuclear weapons been used? The images you see on the screen here are from America's first nuclear test in 1945, which is the Trinity nuclear test, which was in Nevada in the desert. Now, nukes have been used twice in anger in history. When was that? That's right, 4 days apart in 1945. How many times have nuclear weapons been detonated in testing? Does anyone know? Yeah? It's a vast number, numbering in the thousands. I'm going to show you a video in a sec to give you a spatial visualization of what that looks like. So thousands of nuclear tests above ground, like these ones, in the atmosphere, so dropped from a plane in the atmosphere. Underground tests, like the ones you've seen recently in North Korea and also in Pakistan and India about 20 years ago. And also underwater tests, like the French tests conducted at Mururoa Atoll in the South Pacific in the 1990s. This is the Little Boy atomic bomb. This was a uranium-based bomb. This was the one that was dropped on Hiroshima. This is the Fat Man atomic bomb. This was the one that was dropped on Nagasaki. And this was a plutonium-based bomb. Now, why does that matter? This is plutonium and uranium, two words that you might have heard if you'd studied Year 12 chemistry, perhaps. Well, the type of fissionable material you use in an atomic bomb will depend on what kind of capabilities you've got to produce that fuel. So nuclear material is produced in something called the nuclear fuel cycle, which is an eight steps of quite involved industrial processes. And depending on your technological know-how or a country's technological know-how and economic capability, the uranium path or the plutonium path will be more or less suitable depending on a country's capabilities. The United States, as the preeminent economic and military power in 1945, tested both to see which one was better. Now, is firing off nuclear weapons the only way in which nuclear weapons are utilised? And the answer is no. So they're also used for the function of deterrence. Does anyone know what deterrence is? I'm deterring you from doing something, what am I trying to do, especially in this context? Yeah, I heard lots of voices there. Someone yell out with gusto. Yeah, that's right. So in this case, a country uses nuclear weapons to stop its enemies from attacking them, whether that be with their own nuclear weapons or from a conventional attack. Now, it's not necessarily mutually assured destruction, but the idea is to maximise the costs incurred by an enemy of attacking you first and minimise the benefits to them of carrying out that action. Now, of course, this can be done with conventional weapons. So you have arms races and the building of conventional military capabilities that can perform the deterrence purpose. But if you use nuclear deterrence, it raises the stakes. It raises the costs and minimises the benefits of your enemy attacking you to the nth degree, and that's the reason why states go for this. Now, we mentioned nuclear tests before. I'm going to show you a short video, and this will illustrate the spots around the world. This is a time series video. It will illustrate where nuclear explosions have taken place since 1945 to the mid-1990s. So let's watch. Or not. Never fear, I have a backup plan. So that's an incredible number of nuclear detonations, isn't it? Now, the purpose of these tests is twofold. First of all, countries developing nuclear weapons are trying to test the technology to see that it works. They're trying to test to see if they can take something that's as big as that and reduce it to something very small that could sit on top of a missile. Yes. Not down there, but the Russians have tested in the Arctic. There's conventions and treaties dictating what you can and can't do in Antarctica. And also that because of the extreme conditions in those environments, it would make the science of the testing very difficult to carry out. Yeah. So, yes, there's the technical aspect of why countries test nuclear weapons. But there's also the diplomatic aspect, which is signalling to other countries. If you have, or you're trying to maintain a nuclear deterrent, deterrence only works if your enemy believes that you're actually capable of doing what you say you can do. So the purpose of a nuclear test is to say, boom, we can do this. This is within our technical capabilities, and you need to make sure that you understand this. So there's a diplomatic signalling aspect to this. Now, the video ends in 1996, and there's a reason for that. It's because 1996 was the year that the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty was signed Nuclear testing came to a halt at that time, apart from a couple of tests by India and Pakistan, and now North Korea's 3 nuclear tests in this decade. Now, I should say something quickly about mutually assured destruction as a means of deterrence. Mutually assured destruction means that if my enemy is capable of striking me with a nuclear first strike, I'm equally capable of striking them. So it's a deterrent against a first strike. Everybody loses if someone attacks first. This requires that nuclear weapon states have multiple ways of launching nuclear missiles or nuclear weapons. So let's have a look. Different delivery systems. This one is the classic one that comes to mind, is intercontinental ballistic missiles. And you can see from the picture here that these missiles contain multiple warheads within their nose cone. So they'll get out into space, the nose cone will open, they'll break up, and then the warheads can go off and hit different targets at once. With the purpose being that even if the enemy has missile defences, they won't be able to shoot down all of these warheads at the same time, and targets will try and will still be able to get through. You've got submarine-launched intercontinental missiles. So if your enemy knows where your launch platforms are on land, they can target and destroy them. But if you've got nukes in submarines, they could be anywhere in the sea and not liable to be targeted by the enemy and destroyed before they can be launched. Similar concept, but on land, is the mobile ICBM launcher. So these trucks are usually hidden in well-fortified bunkers underground, but they can be trotted out when ready to launch. The missile will go, can fire off very quickly, and then the launcher can be tucked away safely before they can be targeted by an enemy. And of course, you've got the air platform, strategic bomber aircraft. And we can see, especially the United States, but the Soviet Union, Britain, they've employed various different aircraft as nuclear bombers. You see, this one here, I think that's the B-2 bomber. This is the Americans flew 2 of these from Guam to South Korea recently as a show of strength against the North Koreans while they were launching their rhetorical attacks earlier in the month. We've also got some more esoteric nuclear weapon systems. The nuclear cannon, where a nuclear shell is fired off from one of these to targets in the field. So these are very small-scale nukes. Won't wipe out a city, but they will neutralise an area of the battle space. You've got the nuclear landmine, which you might put over a sensitive area to try and block the advance of heavy artillery or heavy military machinery. And you've got the famous briefcase bomb, where one operative could carry that into the middle of a city and leave it there or conduct a suicide bombing and detonate a small-scale explosion. So you can see there's numerous different types of delivery systems which are designed to maintain this ability to respond to an enemy's first strike and preserve mutually assured destruction. Now, nuclear weapons, how is their use governed? Has everyone heard of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT? Now, let me explain the NPT in a bit more detail. Again, there's a link to the full text of the NPT if you want to explore that. So the NPT is designed to limit both vertical nuclear weapons proliferation and horizontal proliferation. So I'll explain what that means. Vertical proliferation is the total number of nuclear weapons in existence. So the idea here is that countries that already have nuclear weapons should reduce the size of their arsenals. Horizontal nuclear proliferation is the number of states that possess nuclear weapons. The NPT is therefore designed to limit the number of countries that acquire nuclear weapons. And by and large, the treaty has been successful in that regard. There's also a bargain embodied in the NPT, and that's Countries that have nuclear capability are beholden to assist other countries to develop peaceful civilian nuclear programs for the purposes of nuclear energy. Now, if you look on the map here, this is depicts all the signatories to the NPT. In the dark green are the ones that have ratified the treaty and they're legally bound by it. That's the light green ones. The dark green ones are the countries that haven't signed the NPT, but they have agreed to be legally bound by its provisions. So countries like France and China are sitting there. The orange parties, and there's only one, are countries that have withdrawn from the treaty. So they were a signatory, and they've withdrawn from the treaty. And the red countries are parties that have never signed the non-proliferation treaty. So is there anything conspicuous about the red countries? Who are they? Yep, so these are both nuclear weapons powers. Israel, does Israel have nuclear weapons? They'll never admit that they do, but they've got around 100 nuclear warheads. And South Sudan, which is an interesting case that I'm not sure about, but as a relatively new country, they might not have got around to it yet. Yeah. That's still India. Yeah. All right, I alluded to this before also. There's the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. It's entered into force in 1996. And this bans signatory states from conducting nuclear explosions anywhere on the Earth's surface, underwater, underground, or in the atmosphere. And that's why, when we looked at that time series video, that prolific testing that we'd seen prior to the mid-90s effectively stopped. Now, why would it be a good idea to ban nuclear testing? Any thoughts? Yeah, that's one good reason. Especially if you're testing above ground. Mm. Yep, absolutely. There's three main reasons, of which those two are ones of them. It increases the difficulty of states to develop nuclear weapons. If they can't test the scientific and technical capabilities of their nuclear programs, it makes it harder for them to reach the end goal of a deployable nuclear weapon. For countries that have already got nukes, it makes it harder for them to develop more powerful nuclear bombs. And as people from the crowd have said, it prevents damage caused by the radioactivity from the nuclear explosions, which may fall out into the atmosphere and environmental locations, causing harm to humans, animals, and plants. All right, so that's nuclear weapons as a wrap. Any questions about that before I move on? Good. This image, before the nuclear age, this was the most terrifying image related to weapons of mass destruction. The chemical weapons gas mask. This is a picture from the trenches in World War I. So the question is, what is a chemical weapon? What do you understand as a chemical weapon? Yeah, mustard gas. So that's one example. Pretty much, yeah. Yes, any synthesized chemical compound that can be used to inflict harm on an enemy, to cause damage to property and or persons. Now, what do they do? There's four categories of chemical weapons. First of all, there's something called choking agents, and these cause death by suffocation due to fluid buildup in the lungs. There are blister agents, which cause skin, eye, and respiratory damage from blistering, and these can be fatal. And so we look at the picture up here. This is a World War I soldier who was wounded with mustard gas. So mustard gas is a blister agent. Now, if you do a search for chemical weapons on Google image search, you come up with all kinds of horrific images. This was one of the more tasteful ones I put up, but I could have put up things that were really difficult to look at, and I didn't want to do that in this context. A third type of chemical weapon are blood agents. Now, these cause death by respiratory failure, which is because the blood is robbed of oxygen in people that are exposed to this kind of agent. And finally, there are things called nerve agents, which cause death by asphyxiation due to a breakdown of nerve synapses. So these are very, very nasty weapons. And you can see, again, they have a great psychological impact. So, what's their purpose then? First of all, asymmetric warfare. This is a good reason to use chemical weapons. If you're a state that has to overcome a significant numerical disadvantage vis-a-vis your enemy, a weapon like chemical weapons, and nuclear weapons for that matter, can help to redress that imbalance. As I've mentioned, and as, again, the picture of gas masks suggests, chemical weapons have an immense, powerful psychological effect. They can terrify the enemy. So using them not only creates harm and damage, but it also has a psychological effect on your enemy. And a third reason is something called area denial. Now, what's area denial? It's the idea that you can depopulate a given area to deny it to the enemy. So even if it's heavily polluted, the idea is that the enemy can't have it, even if you can't. Another aspect of area denial is defoliating the area. So this is something we saw in the Vietnam War. Removing the plant and tree cover so that your enemy can't hide under there, and then they can be attacked conventionally. And it can also be used against animals. Now, why would you want to target animals? A bit louder? Yeah, that's right. So if you want to starve out your enemy, kill their sources of food. So this is something that chemical weapons can be used for. Now, these types of weapons are rarely strategically decisive. They haven't been used all that much in recent decades because they're not very well suited to modern-day warfare. Most military conflicts in the world today are low-intensity conflicts. It's not state-to-state, army versus army conflicts like we saw in World War I. There's a lot of urban warfare, a lot of guerrilla tactics, counterinsurgency campaigns. So the battle lines in conflicts like this are blurred. So if you use chemical weapons indiscriminately, you can kill a lot of friends as well as your enemies, which would defeat some of the strategic purposes that you're intended to achieve. So, how have chemical weapons been used in the past? I'm going to show you some examples here. Given the graininess of this image, when do you think this took place? Yeah, this is a World War I example. This was taken behind German enemy lines on the Western Front in World War I. It's important to remember, though, that both sides used chemical weapons in World War I, and no one was blameless. And this was really the first application of industrial-scale warfare. So it's no surprise, then, that industrial processes that beforehand had never been used for war came to be used as a weapon. So chemicals, an invention of the industrial age, became used as a weapon in World War I. Where is this, do you think? And what are they doing?
Agent Orange?
Yes, this is Agent Orange. This is a defoliating chemical weapon designed to destroy the ground cover and flush out the Viet Cong so that the Americans could target them. Now, of course, spraying these chemicals on a wide scale across the Vietnamese landscape has had lingering effects because of the pollution. So we see cancer clusters in this area, birth defects, cancers, that kind of thing. The Iraqis used chemical weapons on several occasions. First used against Iranian human wave attacks in the Iran-Iraq war in the early 1980s. So Iraq perceived that it had a numerical disadvantage on the battlefield vis-a-vis its Iranian enemies, so it used chemical weapons as a means of equalising that imbalance by taking out these human wave attacks with chemical weapons. But Saddam Hussein, when he was in power, also used chemical weapons against other people. Who were these other people?
Kurds.
That's right, the Iranian Kurds. So pictures down here. This is of the Halabja massacre, which happened later in the 1980s, where the Iraqi regime used chemical weapons against its own citizens. And this use of chemical weapons was the basis for the UN weapons inspections regime in Iraq through the 1990s. And it was also argued by the George W. Bush's government that Iraq still maintained this capability in the early 2000s. It was the basis for their claims to justify their invasion of Iraq in 2003, claims that ultimately proved false. Now, disturbingly, chemical weapons are not just the province of states. Because chemical weapons are relatively easy to manufacture, anyone with a rudimentary sort of high school style chemistry lab could make some of these agents, it's often been argued that non-state actors, like terrorist groups, can use chemical weapons. And we have seen this in the past. So in Tokyo, in 1995, we saw a doomsday cult called the Aum Shinrikyo sect release sarin nerve gas into the Tokyo subway system and killed numerous people. Now, how are chemical weapons governed? They're governed by an international treaty called the Chemical Weapons Convention. Now, this convention has been a success in that chemical weapons have largely lost their strategic legitimacy as a battlefield weapon. And the fact that they've hardly been used at all in the last 20 years is good proof of this, claims against the Syrian regime recently notwithstanding. The convention has been less successful in other regards, however. So, for example, the US and Russia are behind schedule in eliminating their chemical weapons stockpiles. Several countries have neither signed nor acceded to the treaty, so there's several outstanding cases. Israel and Burma have signed but not ratified the treaty. Remaining stockpiles of chemical weapons are vulnerable, are a security risk because they can be diverted to third parties if security is breached. There have been allegations that states have used them more recently. So, for example, the Syrian case, or a few years ago, Israel was accused of using white phosphorus munitions in Gaza. So there are problems with this convention. It's not a blanket, but it has been largely successful. And again, full text available at that link if you want to have a look. Now, lastly, I'm going to look at biological weapons. So, from your understanding, what is a biological weapon? Sorry? Yep, a communicable disease. And that could be anything. It could be any pre-existing illness that's synthesized and targeted in a specific place. But what they are biological toxins or infectious agents like viruses, bacteria, and fungi. Now, the key characteristics of good anti-human bioweapons, there's four of them. One, they need to be highly infectious so that they can be transmitted easily. Second, they need to be highly virulent, which is a combination of ease of transmission and a high fatality rate. So you wouldn't use the common cold as a bioweapon because it won't kill anyone. Three, your bioweapon needs to have a lack of vaccines. So if you target it against the enemy, you want something that the enemy doesn't have a response to in the form of vaccination. So there's no defence against transmission. And four, you want a good bioweapon to have an effective and efficient delivery system so that it can be targeted effectively Now, what do bioweapons do? Well, that depends on the type of biological agent that's employed. It depends on the target. So are you targeting one person? Are you targeting a small group? Are you targeting whole populations? Are you targeting agricultural capacity or farm animals? It depends on your target. And it depends on the strategic purpose of the targeting itself. So, worst case scenario, bioweapons have the potential to create a level of destruction and loss of life that's far in excess of nuclear and chemical weapons relative to their mass and cost of development and maintenance. So, bioweapons are cheap, easy to manufacture. Just need a petri dish, pretty much. So again, this is a problem that non-state actors, again, could harness the power of bioweapons to target specific targets for their purposes. Now, this is not something that you can do with nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons development is far more labour-intensive, cost-intensive and time-intensive. Using bioweapons is none of those things. It's very easy. So what then is their purpose? Here we can see these are canisters of sarin nerve gas that are placed in top in the warhead of a missile. Again, the purpose of bioweapons is very similar to the purpose of chemical weapons. Again, area denial, as we've just discussed before. Asymmetric warfare, overcoming conventional military disadvantage. You could use bioweapons to conduct covert attacks behind military lines. So all you would need is one person infiltrating behind enemy lines with a vial, something this size, of a particular agent. Release it into a strategic space. It could be an army base. It could be a civilian target. But very easy to do, very difficult to detect. And you could, using this, you could disrupt the resupply capabilities of your enemy's army, or you could just use it to sow terror and panic within the population of your enemy. Of course, the big difference here is bioterrorism. So there's the great risk that non-state actors can employ this kind of technology in their targeting, and that could be with or without the connivance of a state government. So how have bioweapons been used in the past? This is how the US government defines the threat. A release of a bioweapon could place at risk the lives of hundreds of thousands of people. It could overwhelm public health infrastructure and potentially cause an untold number of deaths. The economic cost could exceed $1 trillion for just one bioweapons attack. And there could be significant societal and political consequences, a direct impact on way of life and the public's trust in government. So that's a pretty big bang for the buck in terms of what a bioweapon can achieve. Past instances of use. The Japanese Kwantung Army between 1937 and 1945 maintained this facility, Unit 731, in Manchuria, in the city of Harbin. And there's rumours that these bioweapons were tested on human subjects during this period. There's been allegations that the Americans used germ warfare during the Korean War. Now, these allegations have been made by North Koreans and the Chinese. Now, we have to put this in the context of the Korean War. This was a vicious war in which war crimes were committed on both sides. So this is yet to be fully verified, but you can see propaganda pictures from the time illustrate that this was a problem. Does anyone remember the anthrax attacks of 2001? This came hot on the heels of the 9/11 terror attacks. A number of envelopes were sent in the mail to American congressmen and also to particular media figures. And it was discovered that these anthrax spores were manufactured at a US Department of Defense facility. So this was US military weapons grade anthrax, and there's conjecture as to how the person who sent these letters got hold of these particular materials. The use of biological weapons, as with the other forms of WMD, is governed by an international convention, and that's the Biological Weapons Convention, full text available on that link. So this was brought in 1972. It was added to the 1925 Geneva Protocol, which banned the use, but not the possession, of bioweapons. In the BWC, both use and possession were banned. Now, there's a drawback to the Biological Weapons Convention. Although it outlaws the possession of bioweapons, it doesn't have any provisions for reducing existing stockpiles, which means that stockpiles like the American anthrax stockpile are vulnerable to diversion to third parties if there's a security breach, and that's exactly what happened in this case. Now, on the map here, you see the red states are the non-signatories. Any interesting cases in these red states?
Luxembourg.
Yeah, Luxembourg. No idea why Luxembourg would be a non-signatory. Any more significant states? Yes, Israel's one. Yeah, the yellow states are the ones that have signed the treaty but have not ratified it yet, which means they're not bound by the treaty until they've ratified. So, when it comes to weapons of mass destruction, all three of the categories I've looked at so far, there's four key issues that are at play here. Safe handling and storage, state failure of countries that have WMD, possession of WMD by non-state actors, and the problem of these kind of weapons being in existence during a period of hegemonic transition, when the international system is becoming more unstable. So chemical and bioweapons are difficult to use and hard to control. They're difficult to deliver in sufficient quantities to kill equally large numbers of people as nuclear weapons do. Nuclear weapons are far more destructive, but producing them is a far more technically and economically involved process. So that's my talk for today. Have you got any questions? Yes.
How would you classify using like radiation poisoning rather than, would that be nuclear or chemical? You know,
yeah, I think under the convention that would fall under nuclear,
okay.
Nuclear weapons use, because it's a radiological weapon as opposed to a nuclear weapon per se. All right, by the rustling of notebooks and bags, sounds like you guys are ready to go. So thanks for your attention today, and I'll be back on Thursday.